Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. Continuing our presentation of the museum's four-year-long series on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we'll hear the third of three talks on the year 1863. Returning for a second appearance, having given the first lecture of the current series, our guest speaker will be Mark Scherer, Associate Professor and Chairman of the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The title of his presentation will be Lincoln at Gettysburg, Finding Meaning in an Ongoing Tragedy. Dr. Scherer will seek to illuminate the events of late 1863, including President Lincoln's continuing frustration with his military leaders, the political tensions of the time as the 1864 presidential election loomed on the horizon, and the ongoing ebb and flow of the military struggle, including key engagements at Chickamauga and Chattanooga. He'll also offer insights into one of the most resonant events in American history, Lincoln's delivery of his famous Gettysburg Address in November 1863, and its ongoing legacy in American history and culture. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 19, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
We are continuing our series, the 150th anniversary of all things the Civil War. This year, in 2013, Dr. Danielle Battisti and Dr. Mark Scherer have provided the programming. We're very grateful for their involvement. We've had an outstanding year, a great reception for it. And we will continue next year in 2014 with the same style of programming. Dr. Mark Scherer is the chair of the history department at UNO, and as we discussed prior, all-around great guy and a fantastic dancer as well. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark, and he's going to share with you tonight the story of late 1863. Mark?
Thank you. Thank you, Mick. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. It's been a great thrill for I know Danielle and myself to offer this programming this year, and it's particularly great to be here on this particular date, this particular night, November 19th of 2013, because as I'm sure most of you are aware, we are here to the day commemorating the 150th anniversary of one of the most iconic events in American history, Lincoln's delivery of his famous Gettysburg Address. And, you know, as Mick has indicated, and I think most of you have been at past sessions like this, we're trying to trace the key events of the Civil War during each of the successive years. And, of course, tonight we're talking late 1863. But I think if you ask any Civil War historian or any American historian of any of any stripe, any discipline, and you ask them about late 1863, almost everyone's going to go directly to the Gettysburg Address. There were other things happening, to be sure, and we'll address some of those as we go along. But certainly the key event of late 1863 was, in fact, the Gettysburg Address. And so it will be Lincoln's words at Gettysburg that day, November 19th, 1863, that I'll be looking at most specifically here tonight. Again, it is, as you all know, one of the most famous, beloved events, items, speeches, addresses in American history. I think, when I sometimes talk about great political oratory in American history, and if you're asked to rank order the greatest speeches in American history, you could quibble a little bit, I suppose, between Dr. King's "I Have a Dream" speech, which not coincidentally was delivered on the steps of the memorial to this man that we're here to talk about tonight, or the Gettysburg Address. I think those would be in the top two. And it's been memorized and recited by generations of school children, including myself, back in the third or fourth grade, I think, and endlessly analyzed by historians and journalists and other writers. It's just one of those transcendent moments in American history that calls out for further examination, and it's particularly appropriate to do that on a big anniversary like the 150th. So that's our topic. And as we try to bring ourselves into greater familiarity with the speech itself, then I think, you know, forgive me, this is the teacher in me. I want to try to organize this for you in some way. I think we can break it down to three or four sub-questions, shall we say. These are the kinds of questions I want to address with you here very briefly tonight. First of all, you know, context, context, context. If you've been here at my previous talks, you know how important context is to me as an historian. We have to understand what Lincoln was doing at Gettysburg in the first place, what brought him to that place on that day. Asked differently, we might ask, why isn't there a, I don't know, Antietam address? Why isn't there a Bull Run address? Why isn't there a Shiloh address? What is it about Gettysburg that brought Lincoln there to deliver those immortal words? The meat of our discourse tonight, we'll look at the actual words he spoke. What did he actually say in the speech? What was he trying to convey? I think it's intriguing to also think about what he didn't say that we might have expected him to have said. I think we can draw some lessons from that as we go along as well. What's the big deal? Why is it so famous? I have a colleague, Fred Nielsen, at UNO department. We were talking about this the other day, and Fred says, yes, sometimes I say the Gettysburg Address is famous for the same reason that the Kardashians are famous. They're famous for being famous, you know? But what was really going on there? Why is it such a big deal? Why the hype? And closely related to that, of course, then would be the issue of, and this too is one of the most important things that we can do as students of history, remind ourselves why it matters now. I always tell my students, is Maggie here? Maggie?
I'm here.
Yeah, Maggie can attest to this. She's one of my favorite graduate students, and she works down here at the Durham now. You know, there's two things that I want students to come out of any classroom with. What happened, and who cares? Who cares? So we'll try to get to that as well. Now, as we look at context, as we try to address that first question, why Gettysburg? The backstory here takes us back to the event that we talked about the last time I was here, the Battle of Gettysburg itself. We will not refight the battle here tonight. We don't have the time to do that, but we need to give it the two-minute recap in order to set the stage for what's to come. The Battle of Gettysburg, it is the largest land battle in the history of the Western Hemisphere. It was the sort of the turning point of the Civil War for reasons that we explored last time and that I'll allude to again briefly later on. And the story of the Battle of Gettysburg can be said to begin in the early summer of 1863 when Robert E. Lee brings his Army of Northern Virginia north out of Virginia into Union territory. This is an invasion of the Union by Lee's forces, fueled by his great successes at Fredericksburg and Chancellorsville. He's going to lead his forces across the Virginia line into Maryland and up into southern Pennsylvania. As Lee moves north, he is obviously posing a potential serious threat to the security of Washington, as well as Philadelphia and other cities to the north. Meanwhile, Union forces, who will ultimately come under the command of George Meade, are moving up in sort of this direction, trying to screen Washington off from the threat posed by Lee's forces. June 30th and on into July 1st of 1863, advance forces of the Confederate Army sort of stumble into recon forces of the Union Army in and around the small town of Gettysburg. We have this ironic situation of Confederate forces actually advancing toward Gettysburg from the north and the west. Meanwhile, Union forces are arriving in the area, and they're beginning to establish a position along this line here that becomes known as Cemetery Ridge. And over the next 3 days, July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of 1863, the two armies will clash along this line. I'm not going to go into this again. It's far more than we need to get into or can get into. But again, the final day of the battle is symbolized, best remembered, for the futility of George Pickett's famous charge against the center of the Union lines. It is a crushing defeat for the Confederates. And the losses are absolutely staggering. To remind ourselves of the number, more than 50,000 casualties on both sides of the fighting over 3 days at Gettysburg. In the aftermath of Gettysburg, there is this sense that the momentum of the war has begun to change. July 4th, the day after the Battle of Gettysburg had ended, Grant takes Vicksburg out west, and the combined effect of these two great Union victories is, as I just suggested, to sort of subtly shift the momentum of the war. Again, historians will later point to Gettysburg and Vicksburg as the turning point. It will place the Confederates on the defensive for most of the rest of the war. It will prevent them from achieving foreign recognition from the Brits or the French or other European powers. It has a monumental effect on the ultimate outcome of the war. But the big but here is, that the decisive nature of Gettysburg will not become apparent for some time. And in the short term, Lincoln still has huge problems to deal with. First and foremost, Lincoln is absolutely distraught, and that's an understatement, at the fact that after the Battle at Gettysburg, after his monumental defeat, Lee manages to slip away. Lee will lead his forces away from Gettysburg the morning of July 4th. Union forces, Meade's forces, as you saw from the numbers there, have suffered staggering losses of their own. Meade believes he is in no position to pursue Lee aggressively. Long story short here, Lee is able to get back to the Potomac River. He finds that he is stopped there by floodwaters. There have been heavy rains in the area in the days after the battle. Lee is forced to stop, cannot cross the Potomac for several days, and still Meade does not move. Ultimately, Lee is able to withdraw his forces back across the river, back into northern Virginia, where they will, say it all with me together, live to fight another day. Lincoln is furious. I mean, you know, it's his closest associates, John Nicolay and John Hay, his personal assistants, they both, in their memoirs later, said this was the angriest, the most distressed they had ever seen Lincoln during 4.5 brutal, distressing years. He is beside himself. I give you this. I know it's very wordy, but if you have the chance to take a look at it, this was a letter that Lincoln wrote to George Meade, the victorious Union commander at Gettysburg, in which he expresses to him, and this is after several days of letting his anger subside a bit, he writes this letter, and you get to the meat of it here. You can see it says, we could have ended the war. As it is, the war will be prolonged indefinitely. Your golden opportunity is gone, and I'm distressed immeasurably because of it. Now, Lincoln is one of these fellows, and I've done this many times myself. Vent, you know, get something off your chest, write it down. Today it's email, but don't let yourself hit send, you know, don't hit send. And he didn't. He thought better of it. He put it aside. He did not send this, but it's an accurate representation of his frustration at that particular moment. But again, that's just one. That's just one thing he's dealing with. In addition, the great victory at Gettysburg does not lead to a monumental shift in Northern support for the war. There are still significant and large pockets of anti-war resistance and protest and dissent throughout Northern territory. And this anti-war sentiment is accentuated, or exacerbated, I should say, by the fact that many Northerners are not happy about the relatively recent conscription acts, the draft acts that Congress has passed with Lincoln's support over the previous 12, 18 months, that are bringing more and more men involuntarily into Union ranks. The long story short here is that riots break out throughout Northern Territory. And my colleague, Dr. Battisti, was here during the summer to talk about the most famous of those riots, the worst of those riots, the ones in New York City. On the military side, again, I said Lee has escaped into Northern Virginia. He's going to, again, live to fight another day. Meanwhile, the thrust of further offensive operations by Union forces in late 1864 in the aftermath of Gettysburg will be focused down here in southern Tennessee and northwestern Georgia. A Union force under the command of William Rosecrans has advanced in this area. It has succeeded in taking Chattanooga, driving the Confederates out of Chattanooga, but after Rosecrans has taken Chattanooga, he advances a little bit south of Chattanooga, and he is confronted and turned back in a humiliating defeat at the Battle of Chickamauga Creek by a Confederate force brilliantly led by a man named Braxton Bragg. Rosecrans is forced to withdraw back into Chattanooga, where Bragg then proceeds to encircle the town and lay siege to the town. And Rosecrans' forces are in a very difficult situation. It looks like they could very easily be wiped out. And the point here is, without going into more detail, despite the great victories at Gettysburg, there is no military end to the war in sight. And so, by fall of 1863, much to his dismay, Lincoln realizes that he needs to say something. He needs to speak to the nation. He needs to make some sort of public statement. And he's looking for an opportunity for it. Now, this requires us to think in 19th century terms. We think today of presidents being able to communicate relatively effectively with the public. That was obviously not the case in 1863. The opportunities for Lincoln to deliver a message to the people were relatively few and far between, and he had to pick his spots carefully. It was a logistical enterprise of significant, it was a significant undertaking from a logistical standpoint. He's looking for an opportunity to do it. What does he want to do with this statement? Well, that's sort of obvious from what I told you before. He needs to galvanize support for the war once again. He needs to get the American people to renew their commitment to continuing the fight. He needs to emphasize once again what this war is about and what it has come to be about, because there's been a significant change in that question, on that issue, since the war began. He needs the opportunity to confirm that, to articulate the nature of the new cause that is being fought for. And I think at the most fundamental, at the most human level, maybe at the deepest level, Lincoln knows that he has to attach some meaning to what has become a seemingly endless bloodbath. He needs to help the victims of this great national tragedy come to terms with the sacrifice, understand why it's necessary. As Lincoln is ruminating over these sorts of issues, back at the fields around Gettysburg, the people there are faced with a particularly grisly problem of their own. The stench, the flies, the maggots caused by thousands of rotting human corpses and thousands more dead, bloated horses all along the battle, throughout the battlefield at Gettysburg. This is a terrible problem for the people of Gettysburg, and it's sort of the first of its kind in Northern territory. This is really the first time that the people of the North have had to confront this sort of very tangible reality in their midst. The temporary solution was to quickly bury the dead in very shallow graves, throwing lime over them when possible. It was very difficult to identify many of the remains. This was before dog tags were in use and uniforms were non-standard. It was very difficult sometimes to even determine whether these were Union soldiers or Confederate soldiers. But the effort was being made, but it soon became apparent to Pennsylvania leaders and local leaders in and around Gettysburg that something more systematic needs to be done. The result will be the planning for what will become the first national military cemetery in our nation's history, predating Arlington by a couple of years. The individual who was given the task of creating the design and making all the arrangements for the cemetery was a local politician there in Gettysburg, a man named David Wills. Wills wants to hold a formal dedication for the ceremony, for the cemetery as quickly as possible. Ultimately, The date for this dedication ceremony will be fixed for November 19th. On November 2nd, not all that long before the ceremony itself, Wills sent this message to President Abraham Lincoln in Washington, inviting him to come to the ceremony, and he's asking the president to come and formally set apart these grounds to their intended use and make a few appropriate remarks. A few appropriate remarks. I tell you that, I emphasize that, because there's been an awful lot made of the fact that Lincoln's speech was only 2 minutes long, and it pales in comparison to the oration delivered by Edward Everett before Lincoln that ran on for 2 hours or more. The point I want to make here, and it's a small point, I guess, but Lincoln was never expected to do anything more than deliver a few short remarks. And so we have to understand that it's not fair to criticize him for that. Now, as far as the main speaker, that was this fellow, Edward Everett, that I mentioned a few seconds ago. Edward Everett was a superstar of the day in the field of public oratory. And you have to understand, folks, and I suspect most of you do, but public oratory was one of the great spectator sports of the mid-19th century. The great orators, the great speakers of the day, were as famous for their time as our movie stars and athletic stars are today. And Edward Everett was right near the top of that list. He was a former governor of Massachusetts. He had been president of Harvard. He was a former senator, a former secretary of state, very accomplished fellow. And make no mistake about it, Everett gave a great, great speech. It was universally praised. And it was the Gettysburg Address before Lincoln got up and gave his few short remarks. At any rate, November 2nd, he gets the invitation. November 18th, a Wednesday, Lincoln leaves Washington. He wanted to give himself plenty of time. This is only 70 miles away between Gettysburg and Washington, D.C. He could have easily made the trip in half a day or less. But he decided he wanted to go the day before on Wednesday, the 18th, because he didn't want there to be any problems. He thought if there were transportation problems or he knew there was going to be a huge crowd there. He knew that all the rail lines were going to be full and the roads were going to be choked and full. He wanted to get there. He felt very, very strongly about being there. I'd point out, too, from a personal anecdote from Lincoln's perspective. His son Tad was gravely ill the morning that he left, and Mary Lincoln begged him not to go. They had lost a son, Willie, just a year before in the White House. She was beside herself with distress that they were going to lose Tad as well, and that Abraham would not be there with her. But Lincoln felt so strongly about the need to be there at Gettysburg and to deliver the message he wanted to deliver that he went anyway. Fortunately, when they arrived, a telegram arrived later that night indicating that the boy was feeling better, and Lincoln was much relieved at that. At any rate, the following morning, November 19th, Lincoln and other dignitaries who are there leave the downtown area of Gettysburg and begin to move out toward the cemetery where the ceremony is going to be held. This is a relatively rare photograph. You don't see this one very often. A lot of these photos I've shown you are fairly common. We see them all over the place. But these next two are relatively rare, and so I think they're fun to look at. This is the procession out of Gettysburg toward the cemetery. We can't pick out Lincoln, but you do get some sense of the size of the throng. There are several military bands that are there, we see estimates of up to 20,000 people flooding the town for the ceremony. Another view of the same sort of scene. More photographs from the site of the ceremony. This is one of the more famous photographs, and it's got some captions attached to it that help us locate the key positions here. You can see, and again, you can orient yourself to the battlefield by looking at, you can see there where it references the Culp's Hill. What did I do with my pointer? Maggie, where did I do with my pointer? You're supposed to keep track of these things. Here it is. Anyway, you can see where the speaker's platform is. This is the this was taken early in the morning as the crowd was just starting to arrive. The photographers are beginning to set up here. As you can see, this is the speaker's platform from where Lincoln will deliver the address. This is a restroom facility just behind it. Edward Everett had a bladder infection problem. He had requested a restroom very close to the speaker stand. He knew he was going to be taxed in that regard. And so they provided it for him right here for him and the other speakers. This is a photograph of the throng surrounding the speaker's platform. This is taken about 3 hours before Lincoln actually delivered his speech. This would have been about an hour before the actual ceremony began. I offer you this photograph because it is the one photograph available to us now, although there's some recent ones now that people are saying also show Lincoln. But nevertheless, this is the only confirmed photograph of Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg, November 19, 1863. You can see the little arrow here pointing to him in the middle of this throng. And there's the close-up, the best I could do for you in terms of blowing it up without getting too blurry. This, again, is before he delivers the speech, and you can get some sense of the kind of claustrophobic feel on the speaker's platform there. And if we had time, I could identify some of the other folks around there. This is Edward Everett here. I can tell you that much at this point. Here's a quick look at the rest of the program, and again, the point to be made with this is that Lincoln's remarks were kind of almost not an afterthought by any means, but they were certainly just one piece of a much larger ceremonial program. As I said, Everett's speech was brilliantly executed, brilliantly delivered. Everything it was could have been, everything it should have been, it was. There was some music after Everett's speech, and then Lincoln got up and proceeded to deliver 10 of the most famous sentences in American history. And we get to the meat of this presentation. What did he say? And why did he say it? At the most fundamental level, Lincoln is trying to attach, as I said before, some meaning to what is taking place. He's trying to give comfort to the nation and to the victims of the great bloodbath that's taking place and help them understand why the sacrifice has become necessary. And so he begins. Again, it's become almost American scripture. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth in this nation a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, there are several key phrases there that I want to emphasize to you. He's talking about a new nation. He's reminding his audience that the United States was, from its origins, from its beginning, a novel experiment in a new, unique form of government, a democracy, a republic, a representative government in which the people are the sovereign authority. And that stands it in sharp contrast to the other prevailing form of government, the only other prevailing form of government at that time in the world, absolutist monarchy, divine right kingship, the mandate of heaven among the Chinese imperial court, authoritarian government, top-down government. Lincoln is reminding his audience right from the get-go that we are something new and unique. And more importantly, he's reminding his audience that this experiment in self-government has been founded, again, uniquely in world history, not on some sense of tribalism, not on some sense of ethnic commonality, not on some common linkage to a shared homeland, a motherland or a fatherland. The United States is unique in that we are the only nation at that time founded on an idea, a creed, a proposition, as Lincoln calls it, the proposition that all men are created equal. And he finds that proposition, he finds that birth moment of the United States, not with the ratification of the Constitution in 1788, not with the election of George Washington in 1789 and his taking the oath of office and becoming the first president. He finds it 47 years before. He uses that phrase to make people think about it. 87 years ago, okay, do the math. 1776, that's what he's talking about. And the Jeffersonian proposition that all men are created equal. Lincoln understood, as we all understand today, that the proposition of human equality was just that. It was an idea. It was an idea that was still far from realization. It was a goal. It was an aspiration. And we're still in the process of trying to realize that goal. And again, if this was a class, I'd ask the rhetorical question, and I would expect the students, especially the graduate students, to chime in here. Why is he invoking the Declaration? Why isn't he pointing to the Constitution? Heck, Lincoln was elected 3 years before, almost to the day, November of 1860, on a platform that said he was going to preserve the Constitutional Union. You might think that he would have invoked the Constitution rather than the Declaration of Independence at this point, that we're here trying to preserve the Union. He doesn't do that. I'll go ahead and answer my own question. He doesn't do that because, as we discussed the last time, the Constitution was, in some ways, a deal with the devil. It was an accommodation to our nation's original sin of slavery. It was a necessary expedient to a greater end result. And Lincoln has made that transition in his own mind, and he's trying to bring the nation with him. He moves on. Says we're now engaged in a great civil war. Testing. And that, I've emphasized that word, testing. The Civil War had become the great test of this experiment in self-government. We'd been through several tests before. We'd been tested, I don't have time to go into the litany of all the ways we had been tested between the founding of the nation in 1863. But trust me, we had gone through trials and tribulations up until that time, but this is the ultimate test. Now we are coming apart at the seams. This is the ultimate test. And we must persevere. You know, the other point I should have made before is that from the very beginning, from the time the United States declared its independence from Great Britain and set out on its own path, this path of self-government, republican government, sovereignty of the people, the European powers of the day had watched from afar and chuckled quietly to themselves. It can't possibly work. They'll fall apart. Regional, economic, cultural squabbles, the slavery issue, something's going to tear them apart. And Lincoln is reminding his listeners, and by extension, the American people, that we must persevere. We must recommit ourselves. We cannot allow those SOBs in Europe to be right, to win on this point. In this portion of the address, in his typically elegant way, Lincoln probably gets about as conventional as we might expect in a speech of this type on this kind of occasion. It's in this portion of the speech where he speaks directly to the sacrifices of those thousands of individuals, those thousands of men who died in furtherance of this experiment. And again, if we had time, we could go into all the different oratorical techniques that he uses here, alliteration, repetition of phrases in groups of three, and all these wonderful things to talk about if we had time, but I'll just leave it at this. It is at this point where he, in his typically self-deprecating way, says, the world will little note, no longer remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. And in this sense, he's just simply asking us to honor the sacrifice of the dead. And we move into the final passages of the address. He talks about the need, once again, to rededicate ourselves to the unfinished work that these valiant dead have already begun. It is a call to recommitment. It is a call to stay the course. This is absolutely imperative. This is key language here. That from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. You could have said sacrifice their lives. You could have said they lay dead here before us. This is classic Lincoln eloquence. The last full measure of devotion. There's a lot of biblical phrasing in the Gettysburg Address too. People asked me the last time I delivered this talk to talk about Lincoln sourcing. We can do that if you want to later on, but make no mistake about it. There's some biblical phrasing here that we find references to dedication and devotion and these sorts of phrases. The point I want to make here is when he refers to that cause for which they gave their last full measure of devotion, I want you to understand that by now, Lincoln is pointing out there has been a shift in what that cause is. It is no longer just the cause of preservation of union. Now it is something loftier. Now it is something more than that. Now he seeks to invoke a new birth of freedom. Now, he could have said, and we might have expected him to say, a new birth of union, a new birth of our national unity, a recommitment to making ourselves whole again. He doesn't. That word has meaning. A new birth of freedom. And he goes on and he closes with the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Again, we cannot allow these men to have died in vain. We cannot allow the experiment to die on the vine here. We cannot allow our enemies to gloat over our inability to make this experiment work. We must persevere. Lincoln truly believed, and he had used this phrase in previous addresses, in previous talks, previous message to Congress. He truly believed that the United States was the last best hope of earth. And he was determined to reinforce this notion that the Civil War, this ultimate test, must be fought, and it must be fought to a conclusion to preserve that last best hope of earth. Quickly, what he didn't say. You'll notice there is no mention of slavery by name. There is no demonization of the Confederacy. There is no talk of those evil rebels. There's remarkably little vengeance, if any, no hostility in Lincoln's words. And I mention all of this only because when other speakers talk to you about what takes place in 1864 and 1865, as we begin to think and Lincoln begins to implement policies aimed at the reconstruction of the Union, bringing the nation back together, he will adopt a very gentle, lenient, conciliatory approach. And we see hints of that as well in the words that he chooses at Gettysburg. Now, the reaction, predictably, as always, the contemporary reaction was based on whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Some things never change. Republicans and Republican newspapers immediately commented very favorably on Lincoln's well-chosen words, and you get some sampling of some of the editorial comments here from these Republican newspapers. On the other side of the ledger, the Chicago Times, a Democratic organ. The cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances of the President of the United States. Here's one you might have picked up on in the last week. The Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Daily Patriot and Union referred to the silly remarks of the President. For the credit of the nation, we're willing that the veil of oblivion be dropped over them immediately. Any of you guys watched Saturday Night Live last week? They had a skit that directly invoked this. It was kind of cute. I didn't think it worked all that well, but who am I to say? But at any rate, it was poking fun at the Harrisburg Daily Patriot and Union for this contemporary commentary on Lincoln's address. And you'll be happy to know that just last week, the Harrisburg paper formally issued an apology and a retraction of its 1863 editorial panning the Gettysburg Address. So they're on board now. You'll sleep better tonight. Yeah. Edward Everett, the man who had spoken for 2 hours before Lincoln, he immediately understood how effective Lincoln's speech has been. The following day, he sent this well-known letter to Lincoln, in which he says, it's a memorable phrase, I should be glad if I could flatter myself that I came as near to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes. Gracious words from a very gracious an eloquent man himself. A couple other just miscellaneous sort of points here. There are five handwritten copies. People often say, well, you know, what's the real, you know, what is the real original Gettysburg Address? The answer is there are five of them. There are five handwritten copies, handwritten in Lincoln's hand, copies of the Gettysburg Address. Two of them he gave to his personal assistants, John Hay and John Nicolay. I can talk with you if you want in question session, answer session, you know, about where the others are. But these, I'm just showing you that there are several of them out there. There are slight, subtle variations in all of them, which suggests that even in the months after he delivered the speech, Lincoln was massaging the language a little bit. He wanted to get it just perfectly right. As far as the imagery is concerned, there were no photographs taken of Lincoln as he was delivering the speech, despite the fact that there were photographers there, and that's because, well, a number of different reasons, but the main reason was that he spoke so short, his speech was so short, that the photographers of the time weren't able to get their equipment in operation. These were long exposures that were required for a photograph, and they simply didn't get any shots of him. So most of what we have in terms of the imagery associated with this comes from drawings and artistic renderings. Over time, though, and particularly in the aftermath of Lincoln's assassination, his martyrdom, we begin to see the imagery begin to evolve in certain ways, and contrary to Lincoln's prediction, the world has, of course, long remembered what he said there. The remembrances are all around us. You're probably familiar with the fact that on the south wall of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., the entire Gettysburg Address is inscribed there. It's the Library of Congress, which has beautiful artwork and architecture. If you ever get a chance to go there, one of the seminal pieces of paintings there, again, invokes his famous closing line of the Gettysburg Address. Lincoln's words have had an impact across the world as well. I thought you might be interested in looking at this language from the French Constitution. Article 2 specifically provides that the principle of the French Republic shall be government of the people, by the people, for the people, borrowing directly, of course, from Mr. Lincoln. There's significant irony, I think, in the fact that some of our nation's past, and to some degree still foes, have also borrowed from Lincoln. Ho Chi Minh, the North Vietnamese leader that the United States and the French before us struggled against throughout the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s, loved to quote Abraham Lincoln. And in the current constitution of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh saw to it that these words were embedded right in the language of the Constitution. Deep irony, I suppose, for the 58,000 Americans that died fighting against Ho Chi Minh and his forces. Here's one. Stumbled across this on that interweb thing just the other day. A minor league hockey team out in California, for promotional purposes, in commemoration of the 150th anniversary, decided to put the Gettysburg Address on their hockey sweaters. And I thought you'd be tickled by this, as I was. Perhaps not. But at any rate, if it makes you feel any better, this isn't purely crass commercialism. They're going to donate the proceeds from the sale of the promotional jerseys to charity. But again, it's some indication of the degree to which the words resonate. And they still have an impact. You ought to forgive me for this one quick, short indulgence. I was going through some files of my own grandmother. My grandmother was a teacher in a two-room schoolhouse in rural southern Ohio for some 30 years. And she was a very educated woman, brilliant woman for her time. And she was an avid historian and genealogist. Anyway, I was going through some of her files just a couple of weeks ago, and I stumbled across this faded, torn, old clipping from the Ironton, Ohio Post newspaper in 1909. And it was a clipping, a lone clipping, all by itself, of the Gettysburg Address. And I found that remarkable, that of all the things that my grandmother might have kept, from her long teaching career, this was one of the select few things that she did keep. And it was also amazingly coincidental, since I knew I'd be giving this talk in a couple of weeks. And so I decided to just throw it up there, too, to show you that this was something that was impactful, if I can invent a word for you, in 1909 as well. So we come to the conclusion here. I'll wrap up very quickly. What's the big deal? Why do we care today? What's the relevance? What's the impact? What's the legacy? We need to come back to that question always. I wouldn't want you leaving here without some effort on my part to address that question of why we ought to care. And I've reduced my thinking on this and the points I want to make to three. First, say what you will about Abraham Lincoln, and there's plenty to say. He was a brilliant man. Some call him a hypocrite in some of his views and his attitudes and his policies. You can nitpick at his military policies and his meddling with his military commanders. There's lots to be said for Abraham Lincoln. But whatever else you say about Lincoln, whatever else you think about Lincoln, on that day and at that time, at that place, he found the words. He found the elegance. And really, he's one of a real small handful of American leaders that was able to do this, Jefferson being probably the other best known. He was able to give words to the highest aspirations of this nation. He was able to explain to his listeners and to the nation and to the world what this nation sought to be about. And as we have seen in the French and the Vietnamese example and countless others around the world, his words, his iteration, his articulation of the American ideal transcends this nation. And it transcends the 19th and the 20th and now into the 21st century. Secondly, we've spoken to this as well, but just to reinforce, he is reformulating the nature of the war. He is reminding and confirming his audience that this war is now about something more than mere constitutional union. It's now about something larger, something loftier, something greater. Now it's about union and the continuing fight for equality and freedom. He wants to bring us that much closer to fruition, to success in this experiment that had begun 87 years before. And finally, it's a reminder, as it was a reminder then, it's still a reminder today, that we need to continue to fight to preserve the cause. It's a reminder that self-government is a fragile thing. It's a difficult thing. It's a nasty thing sometimes. It's hard. Democracy is hard. Winston Churchill once said that democracy was the worst form of government ever created by the mind of man, except for all the others. Except for all the others. And that speaks to this point that democracy must be continually fought for. We have to struggle to preserve the experiment. And on that point, I want to close by taking us back, ironically enough, I suppose, to the Constitutional Convention in 1787. The delegates there, the framers of the Constitution, had sealed themselves into Assembly Hall in Philadelphia. They had locked themselves in, literally. And they maintained pretty strict secrecy and quiet about what they were doing as they deliberated the terms of the new constitution that they were creating for the nation in that summer of 1787. And as the story goes, when the convention broke up and when the delegates finally came out after the last session, the people there, journalists and the common people, wanted to hear. They wanted the news. They wanted to know what had happened. Benjamin Franklin was sort of the senior elder statesman, I guess you could say, of the convention, 83 years old, Philadelphia man. He was sort of the host of the convention. Anyway, Franklin comes out of the convention, and as the story goes, a woman in the crowd called out to him, and she said, "Dr. Franklin, what have you given us?" Anybody remember Franklin's famous reply? He said, "It's a republic, madam, if you can keep it. If you can keep it." Franklin was saying the same thing that Lincoln was saying. It is, you know, not quite 87 years later. Franklin's admonition in 1787 still holds today, just as it held in 1863. And for my money, there's never been anyone who has more eloquently reminded us of that simple truth than Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg, November 19th, 1863. That's why I think we ought to know about it. And thanks very much for listening to me. I appreciate it.
We have time for a few questions. We do ask that you wait for the microphone if you want a question, and I'll try and get to you as soon as I can. And also, if you would, please help me and kind of pass it around to folks. So with that, we'll take questions.
It's kind of a trivial point, but I noticed on your grandmother's clipping it said the Gettysburg Speech, and we always call it the Gettysburg Address. Did that change at some point in our history that we started calling it the Gettysburg Address versus just a speech?
I've never seen any comment made on it, at what point it might have been, you know, we started changing the labeling like that. I've never seen. But trust me, there's nothing trivial about it, because everything you think might be too trivial to have been addressed has been. It's just that I have never seen that particular issue addressed. But virtually every other, like every word, every letter of the thing has been looked at, but I'm sorry, I just can't help you on that one.
Did Lincoln hang around and walk the cemetery, and did they get all the bodies buried?
No, there? He didn't. The reinterment of the bodies was about halfway done at the time, and the rest were still buried in the shallow graves, and the process was still unfolding. They were trying to hurry it along before winter set in and the ground got too difficult to excavate. But to answer your question, no, Lincoln left the ceremony area pretty quickly after the ceremony was over. And the ceremony itself had gone on for 3 hours. And the other point to be made here, and it's a personal point, it's a human point, Lincoln was feeling quite ill through most of the day's events, and John Hay later recorded that he just looked ghastly sick as he was delivering the speech, and he complained of dizziness shortly afterwards as well. They got him back to David Will's house, and then he caught a quick train out about 6 o'clock that afternoon and was back in Washington that night. And rest of the story, he was laid up with a variant of smallpox for about 3 weeks afterwards, and was bedridden for some time after the speech at Gettysburg. As a matter of fact, his servant, a man named William Johnson, also who had accompanied him to Gettysburg, also caught the infection, and he died from it just about a month afterwards.
Was he looking for a place to deliver this speech? Why did it happen? You said it could have happened a lot of different places. What occasion Gettysburg was it? The fact that they were dedicating the cemetery there and it all fit, or did they fabricate a location?
No, it all fit together. It all came together nicely in terms of both the momentous nature of the battle, which is one of the points I was trying to make. Gettysburg was such an epic Union victory, even though it didn't lead to the immediate end of the war, as Lincoln had hoped. He wanted to highlight that. He wanted to highlight the enormity of the tragedy there and do honor to the dead. And the, you know, my thing about why wasn't there a Shiloh address or an Antietam address? Those are kind of silly make weight rhetorical devices by me. That's kind of a nonsense sort of thing. There couldn't have been a Shiloh address, because that would have been, you know, a 2 days journey to get the logistical problems would have been difficult. It was still technically, I mean, the Union controlled that area at the time, but it was still hostile territory. The same would it could be said for Bull Run or any of the other. Almost all of the Civil War was fought in Confederate territory. Gettysburg and Antietam, Sharpsburg, are the only large-scale battles that were fought in the North, and those would have been the only possible places that he could have gone to deliver this kind of a talk.
Although there was no direct mention of slavery, one of the main points, if not the main thrust, has to do with, quote-unquote, "This nation shall have a new birth of freedom." Was there a rally in the morality after this Gettysburg Address of the nature of the evil? I mean, did the moral nature of that come through in a very direct way, even though no direct mention?
Lincoln Are you talking about Lincoln or for the nation as a whole?
For the nation as a whole.
For the nation as a whole, I think the best answer I can offer is that it helped move people in that direction because it represents a shift. Again, I fall back on the same theme. It represents a shift in what this war is about. This war has become about the eradication of that original sin. Lincoln had long known from birth that slavery was immoral. His inability to come to grips with the abolition of slavery had to do with legal and constitutional principles, not the morality issue. And of course, with the Emancipation Proclamation that we talked about last time I was here and its effect on the war, and it goes into effect January 1st, 1863, the beginning of that same year, that had started the process. That was a tangible act on the part of Lincoln to begin the process of addressing the moral evil of slavery and eradicating that moral evil from the nation's soul. The Gettysburg Address can be seen as another step along that same path. But it, you know, I would never, I don't think anybody would ever suggest that with these words, and as these words became disseminated around the nation, that it's like a switch going off and everybody comes. It's just another, you know, brick in the wall, so to speak. It's another effort to move us in that direction. And it's a particularly elegant one. It's a particularly eloquent one. And that's what I think makes it memorable, among other things.
Yeah, there's the old saying that, you know, the victors always get to write the history books.
Yep.
Is there anything that's generally considered like a Confederate equivalent to this address?
I've never considered that question before. Well, I think the easy and quick answer, obviously, is no. There isn't anything that would be considered the equivalent. Jeff Davis was never known for his oratorical skills. In fact, in many ways, he was, by 1860, late 63 and 64, he was pretty unpopular himself in many sectors of the Confederacy. I'm racking my brain here to try to come up with some oratorical leader of the Confederacy that could have matched up with Lincoln at his best, and I can't come up with one, to be honest with you. Lee certainly had an aura of grandeur and elegance and eloquence and all those sorts of things, but he could deliver memorable, stirring words to his own troops on occasion. But I can't think of anything that really equates. But again, I'd love to be told otherwise if there is somebody out there.
Hey, can he tell it like he feels it, Mark? You did a great job tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. Continuing our presentation of the museum's four-year-long series on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we've heard the third of three talks on the year 1863. Returning for a second appearance, having given the first lecture of the current series, our guest speaker has been Mark Shearer, Associate Professor and Chairman of the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The title of his presentation was Lincoln at Gettysburg, Finding Meaning in an Ongoing Tragedy. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, November 19, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Patty O'Brien, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.